From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, state lawmakers back in Lansing from their three-week hunting and Thanksgiving break. What are the chances we'll see some movement between GOP leaders and Governor Whitmer in their budget stalemate? Plus, he was once viewed as the prince of the white nationalist movement. Now, Derek Black has renounced everything he'd been taught.
My family had been central to trying to mainstream what they termed white nationalism, which is really indistinguishable from white domination and white supremacy. It wasn't just disavowing the ideas, it was disavowing my family.
Keeping small town newspapers alive.
I really feel like having a newspaper helps us keep an identity as an independent community.
And we'll listen to some new music out of West Michigan. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The state legislature trudges back to Lansing today after its three-week Thanksgiving and hunting break. The big question hanging over the Capitol: can Governor Whitmer and the Republican leadership solve their budget standoff? It blew up when lawmakers passed a budget without the governor's input. She responded with nearly $1 billion in vetoes and millions of dollars in funding transfers. The GOP leadership and the governor then failed to agree on ways to restore the lost funding to the many who rely on it. These include people who count on autism care services.
What's going to happen is families will go without services.
Charter schools.
Unfortunate political pawns being used in this process. It's frustrating to watch.
A pilot program for improving foster care in Kent County.
The concern is that we can't afford to lose progress. My concern is that any transition doesn't bode well for kids and families.
It's just a sampling of the many stakeholders who've lost critical funding in this showdown. Riley Began of Bridge Magazine is here with us. So, Riley, what is holding up a budget agreement with the governor and the GOP leaders?
So the central problem here seems to be this power that Governor Whitmer used that's pretty rare, to use an administrative board to move around funds between different departments in her administration. So she moved millions of dollars around, and Republicans are pretty unhappy about that. She says, "I did it because you guys didn't include me in budget negotiations. You passed the budget to me without my input. So this is all I could do to better reflect my priorities." But it was a rare maneuver, and she made some unilateral changes that they're pretty mad about. So, Speaker Chatfield has basically said, "I'm okay with a promise and some other assurances that you are not going to use this again if we pass an agreement to spend the vetoed money." But Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey has said, "We need this codified in law that you're not going to do this again because we can't really trust you."
And speaking of Majority Leader Shirkey, he was speaking at Hillsdale College not long ago during the break and declared the governor and other Democrats are, to quote him, on the bat crazy spectrum. How did that affect things? What's happened on both sides since he dropped that one?
Yeah, so he actually apologized pretty quickly publicly to the media about that. But Governor Whitmer said yesterday that the only apology she received from him was via text message, and that it was kind of out of context, that she learned about the news reports of this just right after he sent her this out of context text message. But I heard from the spokesperson for Shirkey yesterday, who said that they spoke in person, and he said this morning they had a one-on-one meeting. He apologized in person and that they should be good. He acknowledged that it was hampering the process because she kind of made a point to say, "This is not helping," yesterday.
Well, so here we have lawmakers back from their break. What are they saying about resolving the budget deadlock? Because I've got to imagine the groups who've lost funding are banging on doors and burning up the phones at the Capitol.
Yeah, I think that they're all saying we need to get this solved. There are people who need this money. Where it's going to go is up for debate. Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey and Speaker Chatfield have said, "We're going to try to get this done in the next 2 weeks." Governor Whitmer has said that she hasn't heard anything from them that would move her to support anything over the Thanksgiving break. So we'll see. It's still a bit of a on hold.
And how long are they in session until they break for the end of the year?
So they could go through the third week in December. I think that's around the 17th or 18th, but it looks like they're probably only going to be in session for the next 2 weeks. Shirky said today he has knee surgery scheduled for the 17th, so he is not planning to be in. So the crunch is on.
And so if you're one of these groups, autism support, rural hospitals, rural police patrols, all of these groups that have lost funding, and there's no deal on the budget by the end of the year, then what?
Yeah, I mean, you essentially just lose that money. The way that it is right now, they're already not getting payments. A lot of these payments started in October. Some of them are just losing out on their first payments now, and some of them are going to feel that crunch more in January. But, you know, until this is fixed, they're going to continue to lose out on those funds.
Riley Began, Bridge Magazine. Thank you so much, Riley.
Of course. Thanks so much.
Campaign spending by big companies under the name of a nonprofit group, something that undermines democracy, or companies being good corporate citizens engaging in the political process? Those are the questions at the heart of Craig Mauger's new Detroit News story, tracking just how much money Michigan's largest electric and natural gas utility spent to promote its preferred candidates in the 2018 election. Craig, you looked at spending by a nonprofit called Citizens for Energizing Michigan's Economy. Some people call it CEMI. Who are they?
Citizens for Energizing Michigan's Economy is a nonprofit social welfare organization that's primarily been funded in recent years by Consumers Energy, the Jackson-based electric utility.
And so how much did this group spend in the 2018 election, and on what?
Yeah, so this group, we knew as 2018 was going along, we were tracking and seeing TV advertisements and at least 10 state legislative races, and we knew that this group was doing some other things. We didn't really know how expansive the group's involvement was until this week when they had to file their tax return covering all of 2018. That tax filing showed that this nonprofit, one nonprofit, spent $12.9 million during the 2018 election year. It's unclear whether all of that money went to political messaging and advocacy, but it's pretty clear that a large portion of it did by our ability to determine some of the groups that received money.
So we see, as you point out in your piece for the Detroit News, a TV ad blitz that either promoted Consumer Energy's preferred candidates in these races or attacked and criticized the opponent.
That's exactly right. I mean, these, for people who really want to get into the weeds on this, the advertising that this group funds, these advertisements don't expressly tell people how to vote, so they don't have to be disclosed under campaign finance law. Instead, these advertisements simply criticize someone, praise someone, and then often tell people to call them and thank them or call them and tell them they're wrong on this. So that's how they get around other disclosure requirements that our state has.
Got it. And it was interesting to see in your piece this support or opposition of this group and thus Consumers Energy. It was not along party lines, was it? I mean, you point to the example of Gary Glenn.
Yeah, so they spent heavily through another nonprofit called Faithful Conservatives for Michigan. That's one of the things that we found in the filing. Citizens for Energizing Michigan's Economy gave $5 million to Faithful Conservatives, which was a group that ran ads against Gary Glenn, sent out mailers against them, and then Citizens for Energizing Michigan's Economy also ran ads promoting the opponent of Gary Glenn's wife, who was running for the state house. Gary Glenn was running for the state senate. He faced the opposition in the primary. Gary Glenn's wife, Annette, was running for the state house and faced the opposition in the general election. Gary Glenn lost. Annette Glenn won.
And Gary Glenn, we should remind everybody, chaired the House Energy Committee. And as you point out in your piece, he'd been a vocal critic of the state's dominant electric utilities.
Yes. I mean, he's been probably the number one person in the state legislature speaking out about the powers of the state's electric utilities.
In the grand scheme of things, Craig, how big a player is this group that is funded by Consumers Energy? I mean, is $12.9 million a lot?
$12.9 million on tech state elections is a lot of money coming from one group. I mean, it's a significant amount of money. When you break it down and kind of track how this group spent its money, you can kind of see the impact in specific races as well. In some of these races, this group spent $60,000 on TV advertisements in an individual state legislative primary. And $60,000 doesn't seem like a lot, But when you consider the fact that in many of these primary races, there are no TV advertisements run in the primary, $60,000 is actually a large sum of money. So, I mean, this group was a very big player in the 2018 election.
And how does this fit into past donations by consumers? I mean, there was a near shareholder revolt on the company's lobbying spending just in 2018, no?
Yes. So that was in, I believe that was in 2017 when their shareholders considered a new policy that would have required consumers to disclose more information about their political spending. It was almost successful. It went down. I think it went up again in 2018 and went down again, if I'm remembering the details of this correctly. But yeah, this has been an ongoing topic of conversation with Consumers Energy, with people who are watchdogs of utilities across this state and country. This is something that's been ongoing for a while now.
Craig, has consumers talked with you? I mean, how did they respond to your reporting?
I mean, consumers has answered just about every question that I posed to them. They have taken issue with arguments that this is dark money spending, and they point out that they have to disclose certain information about political giving that they do to the Michigan Public Service Commission, which regulates utilities. They've also repeatedly made the argument that they are being a good corporate citizen by participating in the political process. I mean, they argue, you know, we are a major business in this state. It shouldn't be surprising to people that we are participating in the political process. That's what they've been doing for years now.
Isn't this just how government works? I mean, why should people pay attention to this?
People should pay attention to this because Consumers is one of the largest companies in the state. They essentially have what operates very much like a monopoly when they get customers who have to buy energy from them. And a lot of the regulations that this very powerful company operates under are set by the people that they're working to elect. So for people in this state to not pay attention to this would likely be a disservice to having an electorate that is informed and monitoring what's going on.
Craig Mauger, Detroit News. As always, Craig, thank you.
Hey, thank you.
And a reminder, Consumers Energy is a corporate sponsor of Michigan Radio. Coming up, Michigan musicians team up to help fellow artist Ralston Bowles and his wife Cindy as she battles cancer.
The people who are part of this album include Mae Erlewine, the Accidentals, the Crane Wives, Thornetta Davis and the Larry McRae Band, Appleseed Collective, Aaron Zindel and the Ragbirds, Michigander, Rachel Davis, and the list goes on and on.
That story next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time for some great music from West Michigan as we check in, as usual, with John Sinkovich, editor and publisher of Local Spins. And we are starting out with great music for a great cause. John, tell us the story behind this new double CD Michigan music.
So, interestingly enough, the Accidentals and their manager, Amber Beist in Traverse City, decided to come up with this compilation album because they wanted to support Ralston Bowles. He is a very well-known Americana singer-songwriter here in the Grand Rapids area who himself is a cancer survivor, and his wife currently is battling cancer. And they decided that a great way to sort of pay tribute to Ralston would be to collect a bunch of different songs from different artists from West Michigan and put them all together on an album. And so they sent out some emails, and Local Spin sort of helped as well and sent out a few. And within days, they had more than 30 tracks, and it turned out from a single CD to a double 33-track album. Some of the bands and songwriters actually submitted unreleased songs for this compilation called Michigan Music. And in general, it was just a great way to sort of champion the cause of this guy that sort of championed other artists over the years.
Well, Ralston Bowles actually contributed a track to this double CD. Here's One More Holiday.
When I was a boy, I remember well what filled me with joy. Train rides on the L, pocket full of mints, taken for the ride to stay my mischief bent. When patience came untied, and one more holiday.
One more holiday.
One more holiday.
That's a good piece of music. Tell us who are some of the folks who've stepped up to contribute tracks to this double CD?
Well, it's a who's who list of performers. I mean, the people who are part of this album include May Erlewine, the Accidentals, the Crane Wives, Thornetta Davis and the Larry McRae Band, Appleseed Collective, Joe Hurtler and the Rainbow Seekers, Seth Bernard, Lindsay Liu, Aaron Zindel and the Ragbirds, Michigander, Rachel Davis, and the list goes on and on. And one of those performers is also Grand Rapids singer Hannah Rose Graves, who has really risen the ranks over the last several years to become one of the region's more recognizable performers and whose star is liable to rise even more over the next year or two. And she leads the band Hannah Rose and the Gravestones, which is sort of a blend of Americana, rock, soul, funk, and blues. And she submitted a never-before-released track for this album called Breath to Sing.
Well, it sure has been a long, dark road. Try to learn just about all the things I should know, like what it's like to fly when you hold my hand, what it's like to bury my head in the sand.
Wow, I want to hear more from her. Clearly, the outpouring of response from artists all over the state speaks volumes about what Ralston Bowles means to people.
Yes, not only is he a very well-respected songwriter himself, but he's also one of those guys that when touring artists come through town or when Michigan artists are performing and he's at the show, he will wander around with CDs and help them sell their albums at these shows. He's been the host of the Tuesday Evening Music Club series at Meyer Gardens for many years, and so this is one way where they can sort of pay him back.
How can people get this double CD, Michigan Music?
So it's available at a lot of the shows, the Accidentals, some of the bands will be having this available. Local Spins will be selling them at our Speakeasy Lounge shows on Wednesday nights. It'll also be available at cdbaby.com and also at localspins.com.
There we go. Now we move to the amazing Billy Strings and his new album, Home. Now, remind everybody, we've talked about him on Stateside. He's living in Nashville now, but he is from Ionia.
Yes, he was raised in Ionia, where he actually played in a very loud, very aggressive heavy metal band when he was younger. He spent many years in Traverse City as part of a bluegrass outfit with mandolinist Don Julin. And Billy, whose real name is William Apostle, has gone on to become a national bluegrass phenomenon. I mean, the last year for him has just been this meteoric rise. Not only is he on the road like 200 gigs a year, but he became sort of the cause celeb in the sense of being the top bluegrass player of the year. He received two honors from the International Bluegrass Music Association in Nashville, being the guitar player of the year and the new artist of the year. His latest album, Home, has spent 6 weeks at number one on the National Billboard Bluegrass chart, and he's literally sold out every show on his national tour, and he's coming here to Detroit and to Grand Rapids at the end of the month.
Well, let's take a listen to something from this new album, Home. This is Billy Strings, Taking Water.
Cold, cold ashes on the ground, nothing lost and nothing found, friends and loved ones falling down, can't you hear that mournful sound, nothing left but memories.
You describe Billy's music as psychedelic bluegrass. What is it you think sets his music apart from other great bluegrass and Americana musicians?
He pays tribute to traditional bluegrass music, but he's not afraid to push the envelope. And this album was produced with help from Glenn Brown, who's also well known here in Michigan. And not only does it sort of pay homage to the traditional bluegrass strains of things that he was influenced by as he was growing up, but he also sort of pushes the envelope with some psychedelic sounds and incorporates sort of elements of other music, including rock, that really sort of pushes the envelope and really brings along a lot of bluegrass fans with it. There are a lot of fans of traditional music that have really embraced what Billy Strings has been doing, and that's clear from all the shows that he's been selling out on this tour. He's going to be playing two shows, December 27th and 28th at Majestic Theater in Detroit, and then a very big homecoming show here on New Year's Eve on December 31 at the Intersection in Grand Rapids, a show that sold out almost immediately.
Ooh, well, then people should watch his website or watch localspins.com to see when he's coming back if you don't have tickets for these upcoming shows. He is absolutely fabulous. And you want to wrap things up with an emerging artist alert. Who should we be keeping our eye on?
Yes, we talked a little bit about artists who are more established here from West Michigan, but Sandra Effort is an up-and-coming songwriter, singer, and piano player. She just released her debut EP called River Rocks, and she certainly turned some heads along the way while she's been collaborating with a number of different artists and bands here in the Grand Rapids area. She was once the lead singer and keyboard player for a band by the name of The Sauce. She teaches piano and voice at the Academy of Music here in Grand Rapids, but she's now starting to come into her own as a solo artist.
And I know we don't always agree, but I've always seen that as a good thing, and I hope that you see it the same. Well, I walk up to the smell of coffee in the kitchen.
And she's got some gigs coming up?
She does indeed. She plays Final Gravity Brewing in Kalamazoo on December 13th, The Distant Whistle in Vicksburg on January 17th, and Farmhouse Cider in Hudsonville on January 25.
And there are details available on these artists and, of course, on the double CD Michigan Music. Just go to localspins.com for all the information. Edited and published by John Sinkovich. And John, I believe this is our final time talking music on Stateside, as my retirement is coming up right around the corner on December 20th. I have loved getting to know West Michigan music through you as our guide. Thank you so very, very much.
I really appreciate that, and congratulations to you for an incredible career. It's been so much fun talking music with you every month, and I know that the Michigan music scene has certainly benefited from these Stateside broadcasts.
Well, John, thank you. And now that I'm retired in the new year, I'll be able to get over more easily to West Michigan and catch some of these acts in person. So thank you so very, very much. Happy holidays.
Yeah, you're always welcome here, and happy holidays to you too.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. A recent report from the Associated Press tells us in the past 15 years, 1,400 newspapers across this country have gone out of business. To get a better understanding of just what is lost when a local newspaper goes under, we turn now to an editor and publisher from two small-town newspapers in Southeast Michigan. First, Jim Lincoln. He's the publisher of the Tecumseh Herald. Jim's dad was previously the publisher at the Herald going all the way back to 1957. So, Jim, this is totally in your blood?
Yes. Yeah. My parents moved to Tecumseh in 1957 and acquired the Tecumseh Herald newspaper. Been doing it since...
You're in the family business. Absolutely. Sarah Swanson is an editor at the Manchester Mirror, which she helped start as a blog in 2013. Now it is a print and online newspaper serving Manchester in Western Washtenaw County. Good to have you here, Sarah.
Thank you.
It was according to a story in the Manchester Mirror, we see the town used to have a newspaper called the Manchester Enterprise, and then in 2015 it ceased publication. Why did you jump in there to help start a new community newspaper, which is now the Manchester Mirror?
We were just filling a gap. It was the thing that was most needed in the community at the time. So I went to a lot of different meetings. What was always talked about at the meeting was that there was no way to get the word out to anybody about anything. So nonprofit groups, nobody knew when any of their events were happening. Going to like village council meetings, it was hard to get anything out to anybody. Our community is, it's only a small percentage of people have high-speed internet access. So a lot of communities turn to online resources, which is not an option in the rural parts of Manchester. And so we stepped in to do this.
That is, so instead of saying somebody ought to do something, Sarah Swanson said, I'll do it.
Yes. Yep.
Jim, coverage of national and statewide news, especially politics, dominates a lot of modern media. Why is that local perspective important?
I think locally, it's such a difference in terms of the way we receive, particularly national news, your big cable networks and the way that news is presented. So much is opinion-based now, and I think people gather facts based on someone's opinion rather than traditional journalism. I just find that, you know, when you read local newspapers, you're getting more of a straight approach.
You've said, Sarah, your newspaper's like a string around the edge of Manchester that forces people to look inwards. How so?
I really feel like having a newspaper helps us keep an identity as an independent community. It helps people remember that they're from Manchester. You know, it's got the obituaries, it's got history, it's got events. You know, we have all of the fundraisers for softball teams. We have, you know, the Lady Society chocolate potluck, right? This is the stuff that makes Manchester Manchester, and people wouldn't know to go to it if they didn't have the paper to tell them. So we had a 2-year gap when the old historical newspaper stopped before we went to print from being online only. And it was a serious issue that community events didn't have the attendance.
We're talking about running local newspapers and what is lost when a local newspaper goes under, as we talk with Sarah Swanson, editor at the Manchester Mirror, and Jim Lincoln, publisher of the Tecumseh Herald. And Jim, you said you feel like you're still able to cover all the major bases when it comes to covering Tecumseh, but you've had to work twice as hard with a leaner staff, fewer pages in the paper itself. What else have you had to cut back on in terms of news coverage?
Tecumseh's surrounded by the village of Clinton to the north and Britton to the east. And we used to have correspondents in those communities. We just cannot afford that extension. We do cover those communities when there's major events and news. We're still encompassing that area, but you know, Tecumseh is really our main focus, and we do run on a leaner staff today.
As our papers everywhere, no matter what the size. Sarah, what is your paper try to cover? Yeah. What is your staffing like? I'm wondering, are you able to make it to every local government meeting? And what do people lose if you can't?
So right now, it's mostly me and Marcia Chartrand, and she and I do half of the writing each. We mostly focus on news articles. So that's meant that we've left sports out completely because we would need a whole nother person in order to do that. We're looking at growing in that direction. But it is basically news. And actually, covering the government meetings, we have 5 municipalities that we try to cover. It's 4 townships and our village. And it's hard. And we're trying to figure out how better to do it. And it's having better relationships with the township supervisors. We're building relationships. We have a very good relationship with the village, so we can get whatever we need from them. One of our goals down the line is to record all of those meetings and put them on the internet or stream them, just because we can't physically attend all of the meetings and cover them.
You know, journalists love to talk about the Fourth Estate and how informing voters through the press is crucial to a functioning democracy. How do you think it affects voters and politicians when there are fewer journalists, especially journalists writing about issues that affect local communities?
That's very concerning. Journalists can be government's best friend. We're there to help maintain credibility and trust. You lose the trust with your constituents, you're jeopardizing your whole government process and how effective you are. I know Sarah mentioned earlier about building relationships, and that is so important.
And does that, Sarah, turn down the fire of political polarization by everybody knowing that they've got a place to go to for what you work to be? You work very hard to make this impartial, it's not cable news. You are here to say, here's what's going on. Here, we're presenting you the facts, and people feel that they can write in and they can share opinions. Do you think that turns down the fire that this country's kind of burning under right now with polarization?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's something that I've noticed as we've gone along. Local issues almost never break down along conservative and liberal lines. So what happens is we have really contentious issues. One of our townships tried to pass a bill to build broadband themselves. That was like 6 months of uproar, but it did not fall down at all along Republican or Democrat or liberal or conservative lines. And so what these issues do, they're issues that I don't think people would even be aware of, or at least to a much more limited extent, if it wasn't in the newspaper every week. It makes strange bedfellows. So you find yourself lined up with people that you don't agree with politically on a larger scale.
Well, I'm thinking of not a small local paper, but the Washington Post has at that masthead, when you go on their website or you read the paper, democracy dies in darkness. And it feels as though you working in at the local level, keeping these local papers alive, are doing what you can to make sure that light's still going.
Absolutely.
There. If we were sitting here 5 years from now, where do you see the Tecumseh Herald?
I see us still printing. I think newspapers have proved to be resilient over the decades, facing radio, facing TV, facing probably its biggest challenge with the internet and the new distribution of information. I think people are going to look for what is most creditable for them. And I think it's going to come back to your local source, the source that's in your backyard, the people that you work with.
Sarah, where do you want to see the Manchester Mirror in 5 years?
Well, we've been growing this whole time. I hope we can continue to grow. I would like to see us be a 16-page paper with lots of advertising, fully self-supporting, so that someday I can retire. I don't know if that's where it would be, but that would be my goal.
Sarah Swanson, editor at the Manchester Mirror, Jim Lincoln, publisher of the Tecumseh Herald. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Coming up, he was once viewed as the prince of the white nationalist movement. Now, Derek Black renounces everything that he'd been taught.
My family had been central to trying to mainstream what they termed white nationalism, which is really indistinguishable from white domination, white supremacy.
His story after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How do we rein in the rising number of hate crimes? FBI statistics show that Michigan has seen hate crimes go up for the second year in a row. Indeed, of all 50 states, Michigan is number 4 in the number of hate crimes. State Attorney General Dana Nessel has begun a new hate crimes unit where reportedly hundreds of complaints have been lodged. Civil rights groups say after the election of President Donald Trump, there has been a spike in hate crimes and people joining white nationalist groups, which leads us to Derek Black. Derek was born into a hothouse of white nationalism. In fact, he was seen as the future of the white nationalist movement. But an invitation to a Shabbat dinner started Derek along a path that led to him rejecting everything his family had taught him. He told his story at the Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills earlier this year. Here is my conversation with Derek Black. So it is absolutely no exaggeration to say that white nationalism was what you were learning from your first breath. Your father, Don Black, created Stormfront, the first major hate site on the internet. Your godfather, David Duke, the former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. So growing up, Derek, what did you believe about white people, about people of color, people who were Jewish? What were your beliefs?
For the decades before I was born, my family had been central to trying to mainstream what they termed white nationalism, which is really indistinguishable from white domination and white supremacy. And they had spent all of their lives as their primary goal was to try to take it from being a fringe movement into something that much larger groups of people could identify with. And the tenets of their belief were that race was super real, was not a construct, but was actually something biological that predicted all this stupid stuff about people, that you could tell crimes people would commit, specifically that non-white people were going to commit more crimes, and all these things that do not hold up in any way, but have a really long legacy in America. And the white nationalist movement still does base it all in a very firm conspiracy theory about anti-Semitism, that it is Jewish people in this organized global conspiracy that are promoting multiculturalism and immigration and integration, and who are responsible for all the improvements in society for the lives of people of color. It's sort of a condescending conspiracy theory that it's that advancements in society are not made by the different groups in America that have faced oppression, but that it's a Jewish conspiracy that promotes it at the expense of white people. And from the time I was a kid, that was what we always learned.
So when a white nationalist commits some very violent act, let's point to Dylann Roof, who knew Stormfront. He was on that site a lot, killing 9 black worshipers at a church in Charleston. How would your father have put that in context? What would he have thought of that?
Every time an attack like that happens, his explanation is always that it is a series of very unfortunate coincidences that people who came on and read the website and were engaged in the white nationalist ideology then went off to commit violent crimes. Like he would say, you don't blame Google when somebody searches on their website and then goes out and commits crimes. And it's a complete fallacy, like baked into the white nationalist ideology, even though the vast majority of people involved in this movement are not committing violent crimes. Like that is true. The however many thousands of people are involved in it, baked into the ideology itself is the call to violence. Like my father would never call for violence. Crimes and advocacy of crimes are illegal on Stormfront. Like you're banned if you say things that are illegal on Stormfront. But the basic ideology is that whole swaths of people living in America don't belong here and are taking from us and are not us and are hurting us. Like this oppositional us versus them language, it's an implicit call to violence. And the fact that they do not take responsible for their role in it is unconscionable.
When you headed off to New College of Florida for your undergraduate study in history, people in the white nationalist movement definitely knew you. You were really a star in that movement. But you kept all of that very quiet until April 2011, and you're overseas doing a study abroad semester. Somebody researching terrorist groups comes across you, and that news lit up the campus. You were outed, but you came back, kept attending classes. How did students treat you?
Because I was not on campus, I initially got to view that from afar, reading the student forum, which was an email forum where everybody on campus could speak their mind and read what was going on. And that was my first experience of the campus reaction. And it was, from the beginning, sort of a debate about whether we should reach out to this guy, me, whether we should reach out to this person just advocating white supremacy on the radio and in on a website and online and to the media, or whether we should ostracize him in order to assert that we value people of color and Jewish people and people who are threatened by this ideology. And there were definitely people who took this position like, oh, we should reach out, which I think becomes important in my story. Like it's essential that people did that. But I also really want to make the point that the ostracism was essential too. It didn't feel good. It felt really bad. But the fact that this small campus community that I had gotten to know for a semester before they knew anything about my background was articulating that I was making their lives worse by what I was advocating, and that I was factually wrong, and that I was misrepresenting statistics, and on, these people who I'd gotten to know were telling me, either to my face or on the student forum, that what I was doing was awful. Like that was the precondition to even considering talking to some of the people at the Shabbat dinners or any of the people who reached out to me and asking them, like, do you agree with this? Like, is what I'm doing actually so wrong, or do they misunderstand it? It's the ostracism that was the first thing. It was essential. I think it always is essential.
That is something. And then you mentioned the Shabbat dinners, and your conversion, if you will, began with an Orthodox Jewish student named Matthew Stevenson saying, what are you doing Friday night? And he invited you to his weekly Shabbat dinner, and you accepted. Why?
I mean, there's sort of a basic level that there were not too many social events that I was being invited to. But I also knew Matthew. Like, I had been on campus for a semester. He had lived catty corner to me in the dorms. We had taken some of the same classes and shared study guides. I would play my guitar out on the stoop by my dorm, and he would come out and sing along. We had each other's cell phone numbers. And when I came back, he wasn't just some random student. We weren't extremely close, but he was somebody who I knew. And I knew that it would be at least an interesting social event. And I knew him, and I said yes. And I probably thought that I was only going to go once, but it was this sort of social connection that I think, looking back on it, it illustrates that you never know what impact you can have. Like, you never know what connection you have and what input you have to another person. And it's different for everybody. But the fact that Matthew took the fact that we had each other's numbers and we sort of knew each other to say, I'm going to invite him and see what happens. It's amazing to me.
And the story of these dinners and your circle of friends changing and growing, including a roommate of Matthew's named Allison, who wouldn't even come out of her room the first night you turned up. But friendship grew, and then with Allison even more, and love grew, and that gave her a space to really begin debating you about your beliefs. And as people confront white nationalism in this country, people who believe what you used to believe, and now you look at it and say it's wrong, it's stupid, what's the key to being able to confront that, talk about it, debate it?
I think it's difficult because I don't want to be at all giving the impression that what you should do, we have to invite Nazis to dinner and then everything will be fine.
Right.
I think on its face, people understand that, that there's so much more to it. And it takes a lot of different forms. I want to emphasize that the fact that my campus community was really strongly saying how wrong I was the essential precondition. And that's something that most people can do. And I think it has a lot more value than we sometimes give it. That if you're living in a community where anti-immigrant sentiments are coming up, where things that are attacking groups of people in your community are happening, just asserting that that is not the value that you want your community to be known for or to support, like that has so much value. That standing in line at the grocery store and a quick comment to somebody, whether it's friendly or even a little bit chastising, can have this impact that you don't know. And so the lesson that I take from it, which is backed up by research, is that everybody has a different role. Like everybody has a different input, and it's not everybody's place to go protest. It's not everybody's place to run for office. It's not everybody's place to be in media or speaking or so on and so forth. But it is everybody's place to do something, to not be complacent. And whether that's like talking to your cousin at Thanksgiving or whether it is organizing a group in your community, like it takes so many different forms. But the one thing that everybody at New College did was something. They spoke up, they spoke to a friend, they spoke on the forum, they spoke to me sometimes, like they spoke to people who felt threatened on campus, like they all did something. And that's what's important.
And as in fact, I want to encourage people to check out your story told in a very powerful book by Eli Saslow called Rising Out of Hatred, The Awakening of a Former White Nationalist. It is a very, very powerful read, particularly the point by the fall of 2013, when you accepted that what you'd known all your life was wrong, and you wrote basically a manifesto disavowing white nationalism. How did it feel as you sent that statement out to the world?
It's still one of the most difficult things, maybe the most difficult thing I've ever done, because by that point, I had been on campus for years talking to Allison, talking to Matthew, who was hosting the Shabbat dinners, and Allison, who was his roommate. And I thoroughly believed by that point that the evidence that white nationalists used was faulty science and was bad reasoning and that it was actively hurting people in America. But it was still such a difficult move that I did not want to do up until the very end to disavow it, because it wasn't just disavowing the ideas, it was disavowing my family and the cause that they had fought for all their lives and continue to advocate. That break was just terrifying. And it was in some ways kind of worse than I even expected, because it was really unclear whether we would ever be able to speak again after that.
And where are things with your family now?
Extremely tense. They continue to advocate white nationalism and organize one of the largest communities in the world for it. And so we're on these different divides of what is the right thing to do, where we each think the other one is doing the wrong thing. But I give them a lot of credit because it was somewhat in their court that my parents thought it was important that we be able to stay in touch. I've visited a few times over the last 5 or 6 years since I renounced the movement. And we have some amount of connection that maintaining that to some degree was more important than just cutting it out because of these ideological differences.
Recent FBI statistics tell us Michigan has seen an increase in hate crimes 2 years straight. In fact, of all 50 states, Michigan is number 4 in the number of hate crimes. And now Attorney General Dana Nessel in our state has got a newly formed hate crimes unit. And she's saying she's receiving hundreds of phone calls and emails to this, that people, in her words, are afraid to send their kids to schools to pray in their mosques, which is not the way we should be living in America. From your perspective, where you've lived both sides of the equation, what do we do with this?
There is no easy, easy answer. And it's something that I feel personally not necessarily responsible, but some of the things that people who go and do these violent attacks say motivated them are the same sort of ideology that my family continues to advocate and that I advocated, even if they will say, oh, we're not advocating violence or crime. We're just saying that white people deserve a chance or whatever they frame it. And so when these things happen, the fact that you can't take them back is unnerving and disturbing. And I try to find answers to it, to how to prevent it. And there's short term, there's law enforcement, but long term, the only real answer I have is that this is a society-wide issue. that white nationalism doesn't come out of nowhere, that it's not an alien philosophy that has nothing to do with America or its culture. The things that white nationalists believe are almost all rooted in racist ideas or anti-Semitic ideas that exist and have existed in America for decades or even centuries. And it is challenging those ideas where they exist in much more moderate ways in large numbers of people that I think is the best way we will take the wind out of the sails of the white nationalist movement. That we have to accept that it's not just these crazy fringe people who perpetuate racism or racist ideas. It's all of us participating in society that we have to be aware of. We have to be aware of inequalities. We have to be aware of systemic issues. We have to be aware of policing and criminal justice and like things that all feel much bigger than us, but amount to a system that is fundamentally unfair because of racist ideas. And if we can't, as a society, say that we want change, that we don't accept those things, then the white nationalist movement is probably not wrong in saying that they have support for their more extreme beliefs.
Derek, when I think of Charlottesville and what happened in August 2017 when Heather Heyer was killed during that huge white nationalist rally, what did that moment represent to the alt-right?
The moment when it happened, I remember watching the news and thinking at first that it's sort of interesting how brazen they are, that they're not worried about being identified online, which frequently leads to losing your job, and that there were so many different organizations that historically didn't like each other that were together at that event. But I also thought this is going to be kind of a disaster for them because it looked terrible. They had swastika flags. They were trying to appeal to people in Virginia and in the South who want to maintain Confederate memorials, but they showed up and yelled about Jews and swastika flags, and it seemed like the end. And then there was a murder of a protester, and all these things made this movement not seem like the moderate position that they were trying to promote. And I think the thing that really changed that event was the president not being able to condemn them, because people are always able to condemn a white nationalist rally. And the fact that he couldn't do that was something that makes Charlottesville stand out. And overall, I think it has been devastating for them as an organized movement, because America has reacted to the white nationalist movement, and some of the people who showed their faces did lose their jobs. Mm-hmm. Like, there has been a social backlash to white nationalism and white nationalists. But regardless, the fact that the president was able to look at that rally and defend them to some extent, it was huge for their movement, and it's going to continue to be huge for their movement.
Facebook responded to the Christchurch, New Zealand mosque shootings by banning white nationalism and white separatism. Is that too little, too late? I'm wondering what more you think social media platforms can and should be doing.
The backstory of that is, I think, somewhat remarkable, but it leaked more than a year ago that Facebook made this moderating distinction between white supremacy and white nationalism, that they would not allow anybody who said they were advocating for white supremacy, but they would allow somebody who was advocating for white nationalism, because nationalism is not necessarily opposition to anyone else, which every sociologist and anthropologist and political scientist in the world who they asked said there's no distinction, that white nationalism is a phrase that was adopted by my family just for this reason, to make it a little bit more palatable, that inherently these movements in America are oppressive and potentially violent towards people of color, towards minority groups. And the fact that it took them more than a year and the conspicuous timing of it happening after the attack in Christchurch, where a person who advocated white nationalism killed 50 people in a mosque. And I think that we're sort of as a society coming to the realization that these private companies are not blameless, that if they promote and help an organization organize and spread its message, that they can't fall back and say, well, we are just supporters of free speech and we allow anything, because they don't allow anything. They decide what goes on their site. And if they decide that something is acceptable and they therefore help that ideology spread and more people come around to it, then they are supporting it, they're promoters of it, and they're platforms for it. I think 2019 might end up being the year where these major companies acknowledge that, even if it's detrimental to their business model.
Derek Black, thank you so very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we always love to hear from you. What stories or people are you focused on, or issues that you want to hear more about? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio, or send us an email to stateside@michiganradio.org. And that's today's show. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber-Davis, Tad Davis, Mercedes Mejia, and Adam Reyes. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.